But the difference to me between them and my real puppies, the team from 2 years ago, they win that game by 25.
If Braylon Mullins can get hot,
you can tell how important he is, because every time he hits a shot, Hurley goes nuts.
Like, if he can get to that next level, which I think is in there, yeah, I think there's a uh-oh factor here. Going against Izzo in March is not a super fun endeavor, but you think back to, you know, Stephon Castle 2 years ago, like, the perfect recipe for UConn, and now they don't have Klingon blocking everything, but Reed's a pretty enormous
Reed's a great
force.
Player, but you see, like, you if Reed gets in foul trouble, but when he gets in foul trouble, they don't have, like, remember the first title, remember if Sanogo got in trouble, and then that, sometimes they were better because then Klingon came in.
Right.
And then it's a lot like the next year when Klingon would get in trouble, they didn't have the depth.
And they don't have a crazy person like Cam Spencer on this team.
And I don't think they feel as lethal from three. Like, the same thing, like, if you had UConn against Furman, it was kind of a frustrating game, because if UConn just shot, like, 20% from three, they probably would have covered the number. I don't know.
But then you see Caravan hit the threes against UCLA.
Exactly.
Like, ooh, it could be unlocked. So, yeah, I just, those two teams playing each other in the Sweet 16, Michigan State and UConn, I'm like, man, I didn't really like either one of these teams. And, you know, Michigan State was just no nonsense. We're better than both of you. We're going to smash
they
both
were,
of you.
They were, them and Houston were very workmanlike.
But now you got a week to digest, and it's like, as crazy as this sounds, do I trust Danny Hurley more than Tom Izzo?
This is Dan Hurley's first Sweet 16 outside of the two title runs. They never made it. Stock down. I'm just saying Iowa State, I understand that they knocked out Kentucky. I think without Joshua Jefferson, they feel vulnerable.
I mean, he's the second best player in the country. Like, yeah. I think people, and look, I bet Kentucky on Sunday, and they were up 7, and then Iowa State decided to go on a 47-17 run.
The play of the game felt like the three at the end of the half, the first half. It's like they played well, and then they went to the break losing.
Was it a Ewing theory deal on Sunday, and now they're really going to feel it?
I think they're a very good team. We're now at the point where you can't.
Lipsy is just a spectacular point guard.
I think Tennessee's better than Kentucky.
I agree. I think Tennessee.
I think Tennessee's in a good spot.
You took Tennessee as that sixth seed, right?
I did.
The only sixth seed in the Sweet 16.
I'm feeling good about that. All right, most NCAA tournament moment. I went with the High Point cowbell guy with the pep band. He was electric.
I miss this.
Yeah. I mean, it is like the Will Ferrell formula of find a fat guy, give him a cowbell, and let him just go ham. It's a tremendous clip. You could also go on with just Chase Johnson pulling up from the logo. And then when he went on Wake Up Barstool, he said he saw someone heading to the bench, and that might be him coming out, so he just fired. So I have to respect
that. The only two-pointer he made of his entire season was the game winner against Wisconsin.
It still felt wrong. It should have been a three.
Should have pulled up on that breakaway.
All right, what you got right, obviously St. Mary's. I want to give a shout-out to my buddy Drew Hill. I was on with him on Friday, and he said, Siena plays slow as crap, and that's 28.5. Let's take it. And I did. And that was a tremendous. Also, when in doubt on the first weekend, if you're just down big and they put the Cougs late at night, just bet Houston.
Yeah, there were a couple that I was kicking myself, you know, going through all of these games. The ones I felt good about. I hit a first of 10 that was really fun.
Ooh.
Yeah, let's see which one that was. Oh, Troy first to 10. Oh no, Kennesaw State first to 10 plus 320. That was
yep.
That was a fun little ditty. Texas A&M St. Mary's under probably mm-hmm. my best bet of the weekend. 147, and we had 113 points. That number got bet up. I'm like, what? And then Texas against Gonzaga. I felt really good about that one. Outside of that, I got a lot of stuff wrong. I will give you the dumbest gambling moment I've ever done in my life.
Go on.
All right. So, you know my affinity for the Bows. They're my adopted team.
You told me about this. Yes.
All right. So
I gave them credit. I thought they played super well in a game where you get beat by 20 and don't cover. It was very annoying because Arkansas.
They did not get beat by 20, sir.
No, they got beat
by
19.
They got beat by 19.
Correct.
Here's the dumbest gambling moment of my life. So I didn't even love Hawaii, to be honest. I thought Arkansas was going to be too athletic. But right before the game, I'm like, I got to bet the Bows. So I bet them in the first half, plus 8.5, loser. Bet them full game, plus 15.5. And in the first minute of that game, I said, oh my God. Hawaii's going to get obliterated. They're going to lose by 40. So I'm like, I got to get off my bet. So because Arkansas got off to a good start,
yes.
I had to lay 19.5. So I have Hawaii plus 15.5 and Arkansas minus 19.5. This is the dumbest thing you could ever do as a bettor because there's a window that you could lose both bets.
Yes, you can.
And sure enough, bang, lands 19, and I'm sitting there going, I am the dumbest idiot ever to walk the earth because I just lost three bets on one.
Why lose one when you could lose three?
Like,
if only you could have parlayed that with something.
You always want to try to set yourself up for a middle.
Yep.
And those are the best feeling in the world.
Not a this middle loss, the, a middle
this
win.
This is the reverse
correct
of losing both. I was like, oh, I did hit one more that I got right. I laid it with Tennessee against Miami. That was a clear, ugly dog situation.
The Vols were good.
Popular dog.
The Vols were good to me this weekend.
Ooh, buddy. Tennessee, good work.
Also, what I got wrong, Troy in the points.
Yep,
got well, that one wrong. Well, anyone playing Texas, which can't wait to do that again. I got Northern Iowa wrong. If Northern Iowa just made like three threes, that game was going to be like inside the number because St. John's can't score. Those were the big ones. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll get into the list. Also, Eric Hasselstein going to join us later this hour. Stick around and listen to Jeff Wright and Company, 92.9 FM, ESPN. Regardless of your home's condition, my friend Josh Heisall is willing to make you a cash offer for your home for the full market value. We've all blown off a maintenance project before, maybe more than one. It doesn't matter if your home is beat up, Josh will still buy it. Rodney just sold a home that he inherited in Memphis, and according to Rodney, in his own words, it was in bad shape. Josh told him to not worry about it. He'd appraise it, let Rodney know what the home is worth, and he'd write him a check. It was that easy. Josh made him a cash offer in less than 48 hours, and Rodney didn't have to worry about any repairs or being inconvenienced by open houses. He didn't have to worry at all. Whether it's with a cash offer or selling your home the traditional way, Josh Heisall is dedicated to making home selling easy. Josh will give you a guaranteed instant cash offer at the full market value of your home. You get the same convenience as all those other cash offers, but you can also walk away with more money in your pocket. He'll even give you some extra time to find a new place if you need it. You won't be rushed. You'll have up to 4 months to hand over the keys. Josh also offers flexible fees, no upfront costs, and he'll let you out of your contract anytime risk-free. So if you're thinking about selling your home, call the only agent that I would trust, Josh Heisall of Team Keller Williams Realty. You can call them at 901-461-8147, 901-461-8147, or you can visit the website, joshhasthebuyers.com. Eric Hasselstein going to join us during the next segment. Before we do that, let's get into the list. Max Crosby. All right, Tim, Ryan McFadden over at ESPN has done a profile in what exactly happened. And here are a few of the things that Ryan notes that I highlighted. Sources with the Raiders and those close to Crosby are skeptical that his medical state was the sole motive for the trade reversal. Given the timing that Baltimore had a full understanding of the injury before the trade. Quote, they had access to imaging and the doctor's reports on it, a source with direct knowledge of the situation told ESPN. Max Crosby said on a episode of his podcast, The Rush, no one will ever admit what the real truth is. Also, Ryan notes that Baltimore beat out the Dallas Cowboys, who are also seeking an elite pass rusher. Initial offers centered on Dallas's second first-round pick at number 20 and defensive tackle O.C. Odigizua. Odigizua. There we go. Nailed it. The Cowboys then offered their top first-rounder at number 12 and a third-round pick. Ultimately, the Cowboys moved to their number 12 pick and their second-round pick, but the last two offers did not include Odigizua, who was traded to the San Francisco 49ers for a third-round selection. Crosby later said on his podcast that he spent March 10th undergoing physicals and getting an MRI, but he said he didn't get a chance to meet with Ravens coach Jesse Minter and DaCosta, the GM, until around 5 p.m., which caught him by surprise. Quote, I thought I was going to see DaCosta when I first got there. I don't know why. I'm not going to speculate. He just made the trade, and I didn't see him for 5 hours. During Crosby's eventual meeting with Minter and DaCosta, he said the energy felt off. He then grew terrified after DaCosta informed him that one of the doctors had concerns about his knee, and they wanted to get additional opinions. In addition to their own doctors, the Ravens had a handful of doctors outside the organization weigh in on Crosby's knee, including Dan Cooper, a renowned knee specialist and the Cowboys' team doctor. In the past, Dallas has leaned on Cooper's expertise in making decisions such as drafting Jalen Smith in the second round in 2016, despite torn ligaments and nerve damage, and Siobhan Revelle last year in the third round, despite a torn ACL. But Cooper was not the primary voice in determining whether Baltimore should back out of the deal. The consensus was that Crosby would be able to play in 2026. The Ravens' concern centered on the uncertainty of Crosby's durability after a couple of seasons in Baltimore because of a degenerative issue in his knee, a source told ESPN. Multiple sources with direct knowledge of the situation believe that the Raiders and Crosby's representatives were transparent about the injury throughout the trade process and that Baltimore had done extensive research on Crosby's recovery and timeline during that time. Crosby's agents, C.J. LaBoy and Doug Hendrickson, told him that after their meeting with Minter and DaCosta that they believed Baltimore would nix the trade. Despite his agents' uncertainty about the trade being finalized, Crosby said a Ravens staff member called him after getting off the phone with his agents and said the team planned to get a deal done. Here's where other people weigh in. Two executives from other teams told ESPN that they were somewhat skeptical of DaCosta's statement. As one NFC executive put, I think the truth is somewhere in between, making it clear that only Baltimore knows the details of the physical. Initially, the Ravens, like other teams that were talking to Trey Hendrickson, were hesitant to meet his desired contract price of a long-term deal worth $40 million a year. Hendrickson, 31, underwent core muscle surgery in December, which is why they were reluctant to give him a 3 or 4 year deal. When no deal materialized for Hendrickson during the negotiation period that began on noon Eastern of March 9th, interested teams received word that his desired contract price had dropped. Once Baltimore decided on March 10th not to move with the Crosby deal, it improved its offer to the point that Hendrickson would accept it. Okay, so the reason why I pointed out all those details is I think probably the NFC executives are kind of telling it like it is, where I don't know if they necessarily went in with the idea of nixing the trade, because why would you make the trade? Why would you get into a bidding war? Like that's what has always held me up. I think that there were legitimate concerns about the knee, and I think when Hendrickson brought his price down, that's when they probably decided to move on.
Yeah, I think we have a similar train of thought here. Once they had kind of heard that, hey, you'll be able to get Trey Hendrickson for the same price, I think that's where they were like, yeah, that knee is not great.
And keep their pick.
And keep both their picks, right?
Right.
They had a first rounder this year, which is 13th, I believe. And
13 or 14, something like that.
It's really the highest they're going to pick for a long, you would think.
They certainly hope so. They're picking 14.
It just, look, if you're the Raiders, you're beyond furious with all of this. And if you're Crosby, too. I understand. I'm not a Ravens fan. I'm a Commander fan. So I'm not like defending them. I get why they did it. Was it dirty pool? Absolutely. But at the end of the day, they get to keep their pick and maybe they get a better player in Trey Hendrickson. I mean, I think it's debatable.
I think Crosby's a better player.
But Hendrickson doesn't have the injury concerns.
The question is, are they a better team with Hendrickson and 14 or yes. Max Crosby with potentially a degenerative knee?
And no picks, no first round picks in the next 2 years. If you're the Raiders, yay. I mean, here's the thing. I don't think Crosby's mad at the Raiders.
No, I think he thinks the Raiders did right by him.
Yeah. Like, hey, welcome back. We know you wanted to be traded. We made a deal to trade you.
To a contender, by the way. Not just straight up best offer. Like they traded him to the Ravens. They got the Cowboys involved to get the price up, and they got him to the Ravens.
So my question now is, why did the Cowboys then drop out? Was it also the knee? Or did they feel like they got enough with who they get from the Packers? They got
Reed, right?
They traded for a defensive lineman.
Was that Rashawn Gary?
Rashawn Gary, yes, thank you. Rashawn Gary ain't Max Crosby. They gave up a fourth round pick next year for Rashawn Gary. But if you could get Max for a first now, like, I guess at this point, we're still a month away from the draft. Are we convinced that he stays in Vegas?
I'm not.
Like, they're saying now, and Max has said, yeah, I'm a Raider now.
I mean, he even mentioned in this piece talking about how, like, you know, he kind of had some reservations about leaving, but he did want to go play for a winner. And now it's like,
well, now you can't go to the Cowboys. Hey-o!
Hey-o! I'm kind of bullish on the Cowboys this year.
Oh, boy.
Although the NFC East, we have to play the AFC West. I'm sorry, the NFC West and maybe the...
Y'all have the AFC North last year, wasn't it? So this year,
but
would
like
be
the Giants still have to play the Lions because the Lions finished fourth. That's annoying. I remember going through the schedule, like going like, eh, okay, the NFC East didn't exactly like come out great. I don't know. I think the other thing that I keep going back to is so much of my business understanding comes back to the late shift. The story of Leno getting the Tonight Show over Letterman. And I always come back to the NBC executive that was very consistent of like, my job is to give NBC the most options. And it does feel like what DaCosta did was once... I think if there were zero concerns over the knee, I think he's probably there. I think there was enough of a concern that it allowed you the wiggle room, and then Hendrickson comes open, and now all of a sudden we have the opportunity to get Hendrickson and keep our picks versus Crosby, and we don't know.
If you're a Ravens fan, what are you feeling right now? I think I'm feeling, hey, man, that's not a great look, but I think we made out okay about this whole thing. Like, if they didn't get Hendrickson, I think you're furious.
Yeah, I guess that would be I think that's the unknowable question is, if Hendrickson would have gotten a deal done, because I think that was the other part of this, is a lot of people believed that they had a deal with the Colts, and then that didn't get done, and then when the Colts came down off the price, or I'm sorry, when Hendrickson came down off the price, that brought in new bidders.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you're a Ravens fan, you're probably happier, because I think part of it, right, is part of your success is we don't really do the splashy trade where we give a bunch of assets, and that's kind of why we never suck.
Right. You're never in Baltimore. You're never in a situation where you don't have your first round pick. And now you've got the 14th pick, which let's say it's an offensive lineman, and you got your pick next year. You have Trey Hendrickson. Yeah, I think you're kind of like, okay, let's roll with the new coach and let's get ourselves back to the promised land.
Yeah, it's like, all right, this is like peak Lamar. Like, let's give him the best shot and let's do that. NIL spending. All right, so Pete Nakos over at On3 has reached out to, I believe it was 14 coaches. Now that we're officially through the transfer portal window, he reached out to 14 powerful general managers and NIL personnel staffers and asked the following questions. Which program spent the most? Who retained the talent at the highest level? Which players landed the biggest deals? And how bidding wars took shape? Sources were given anonymity to speak freely. So the top spenders. Got any guess?
Texas Tech.
Ah, I was thinking of a different one.
Ohio State.
No. I guess
Miami.
No, LSU.
Oh, this go-round?
Yeah.
Oh, my bad.
It says for the portal that just ended.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, okay.
I did not ask a properly detailed question. That's on the host. Of the 14 Power Four general managers and staffers that spoke with On3, 10 mentioned LSU as the top spender in the transfer portal. In their first transfer portal window under Lane Kiffin, the Tigers ranked number 2 on On3's transfer portal rankings. Multiple general managers believe that LSU has the highest payroll in the sport entering the 2026 season, exceeding $40 million. The Tigers landed Sam Levitt, offensive tackle Jordan Seaton, edge Princewell Umamielen. Did I say that right?
Umamielen.
Umamielen. Ultimately bringing in 40 new players via the transfer portal window. They've got the most expensive roster in the sport, one SEC GM told On3. They're definitely at least $40 million, a Big 12 general manager added. Y'all did hit a couple of the other spenders. Texas, Texas Tech, and Miami were the most frequently mentioned as other top spenders. Texas Tech knows they can just outspend you, a Big 10 GM said. Other schools included were Notre Dame, Ohio State, and Indiana.
Yep.
I refuse to believe this is just Moneyball. I also appreciate their approach where they talk it down. I don't believe that it's talked down, though. Also included, I don't know if they spent the most, but certainly Wisconsin surprised some people, an ACC source said. They were told, they told at least 4 or 5 kids that we were involved, just give us a chance, we will be your highest number. I will also argue, I'm not sure that's great for Wisconsin. They're doing the whole, let's go all in, let's try to spend on the roster, give our guy a chance. I also think, though, when you're at the late stage, you start overpaying.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, they are in the, do we spend the money to fire?
Correct. Do we pay the buyout or do we take the money and try to
invest? I kind of understand it, and that's kind of the new era we're in where it's like, these buyouts are so outrageous. Why don't we just spend the money on the roster and give them one last shot? I'm curious about Wisconsin for sure.
All right, this is something that I know we've mentioned in passing. I don't know if we've gone in depth on it. Of the 14 Power Four general managers and staffers On3 spoke with, three names consistently mentioned across the board as the highest paid quarterbacks from the transfer portal: Texas Tech's Brendan Sorsby, LSU's Sam Levitt, and Miami's Darian Mensah. On3 previously reported that Sorsby's deal was over the $5 million mark, but sources emphasized to On3 that Levitt and Mensah were in the same conversation. The price got driven up big time on Levitt. The latest that I heard is he's in a similar range to Sorsby. Sam Levitt is legit, don't get it twisted, another GM added. It's unclear how much Mensah paid Duke as part of the agreed-upon settlement. However, general managers were adamant that he would be one of the top players in the sport. Quote, I would say it's Mensah and then a tie between Levitt, who I heard got $6 million, and Sorsby. All right, here's the question that I have. I think Sorsby is better than Baron Morton.
Yep.
Are we really sure that, like, Sorsby should be the highest paid player in college football?
Well, was the highest paid player in the portal.
Fair. But I think those probably go hand in hand.
I think there's a gentleman in Austin, Texas, making a whole lot of ka-ching. And I think there's a gentleman in South Bend making a whole lot of
kachin. Yeah, I guess, though, the question... Yeah, and that's more than fair. I'm thinking more
I think they're on the same level.
You can tell me that Arch and CJ Carr are able to make more money away from, like, just the collective and rev share.
The Arch of Viore ads that I continue to get.
Well, don't forget Warby Parker. He sucked at football until he got Warby Parker glasses, and he could see.
And how much is Trinidad getting? How much is Trinidad getting paid at Ole Miss? How much? I mean, Dante Moore went back to Oregon. You don't think Nike's uncle?
Well, I mean, what do we think Cal had to pay? What do we think Cal had to pay JKS?
Probably not six, but yeah, he's getting paid a lot for him to stick around. Mateer at Oklahoma probably making a boatload of cash. So. I think the going rate for a quarterback now is like, probably $6, $7 million. So back to your question, is Sorsby worth it? I mean, first, does it matter? Texas Tech just has...
Oh, I don't care.
Money.
It's not the money that I'm spending. I'm also...
But it was so predictable. When you watched that Orange Bowl,
yes.
I was like, they're spending
whoever they identify as whoever they identify as the quarterback, the best available, they are getting him.
Because last year, remember... If you think back, it was like, really? You're going to trust Baron Morton, the guy who always gets hurt? And, you know, he didn't really get hurt. I think he missed, the Arizona State game?
Yes, and that's their loss.
But you were like, wow, you're going all in on Baron Morton. Okay. And they're like, oh, he's a leader. He's been here for the whole time. And it backfired on him. So you knew they were going to go out and spend top dollar. And look, it's true that... retaining your players, and there's something to be said about high school recruiting. If you can find your quarterback via high school, I'm not saying CJ Carr and Arch Manning and Chambliss is different because he was a portal guy, but he might as well have been a high school commit because what was he making last year?
Oh, probably, I think Temple offered him, I think 250, I think probably 500 grand.
Okay, so.
Now, I don't know, like he got an AT&T deal. Like,
yeah.
Right. But just using Carr and Manning, both are obviously very two guys that will have ads, I'm sure, on Saturdays, right?
Yes.
We will see them. By the way, quick side note, did the Boozer brothers have these commercials during the regular season?
I don't recall, but I think these are all planned like launches at the tournament.
Yeah. My God, they're on every commercial now. But yeah, there is something to be said about you pay less to retain. Not a ton less. You're not... CJ Carr and Arch Manning aren't making $1 million. I'm sure they're making five or six, but...
I think the hope is that you can also lock them up earlier.
If Arch Manning was in the portal, he would have made like $15 million. Like, imagine if Texas Tech had a chance to get Arch Manning.
Oh, my gosh.
they would pay $30 million for him.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, Eric Hastein joins us next. Stick around. You're listening to Jeff Wright and Company, 92.9 FM, ESPN. That music means we welcome the Memphis Grizzlies Radio Network play-by-play announcer to the program. He, of course, is Eric Hastein. Eric, I was scrolling over. Obviously, two of the surprise teams in the East and two of the teams that have been playing really well as of late, the Grizzlies just saw in consecutive games, the Hornets and the Hawks last night. The other scorching hot team, who is 22-2 since the start of February, is the Spurs.
Yeah.
The question, though, that I was thinking about before we talk about Wemby is you've gotten a look at the revamped Hawks and Charlotte, who has, you know, got their young guys playing really well. Can those teams catch the Magic?
Yeah, they have caught them.
Well, Atlanta's, I mean, can we knock him back into the lottery so I can get two lottery picks?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we were talking about that last night a little bit, actually, because I mean, all the stipulations got me confused. And, you know, during the season, I'm primarily focused on the game as fun as possible. So I'd forgotten that it was, you know, the lesser of this or that, yada, yada, yada. And you have the Magic pick and your pick and then the swap and all that stuff. So, absolutely think they can. Atlanta, I don't buy into the, oh, they won 11 straight games, but it was all bad teams. You still got to win the games. And if you're not a good team, you're not winning the games. And all I do is I look at their numbers. They are closing games at a ridiculous rate. So if they have a lead or are tied going into the fourth quarter, I think they're now 32-3 or 33-3 after last night. That means that they're taking care of business. That's really good. It also means they don't have a lot of the firepower to necessarily make a big comeback. So they got their better plan from ahead. Watching Charlotte comparatively to, look, I said this the other day to somebody. I was very, you know, kind of proud of myself for 2 years ago when we saw them. I went, man, they got a chance to be good, and then they didn't stay healthy. Brandon Miller got hurt.
Yeah.
LaMelo Ball got hurt, and I was like, wow, that was a tragic over, you know, sight on my part. Because I said, hey, that's when we played them at the beginning of last season, I said, that team could compete for a play-in spot for sure if they're healthy, because I really like Brandon Miller's game. I'm not a huge LaMelo Ball guy, but it seems to work for them. But when I saw Con Knipple and Ryan Kalkbrenner and a healthy Miles Bridges and then a healthy Brandon Miller, and I'm like, oh boy, like they could be a problem. I didn't know what Musa Diabate would be. And remember, their little run of what they've been doing since, you know, January really kind of started when they played the Grizzlies here, and they blew the Grizzlies' doors off that night. They blew their doors off in the preseason. I don't like to put too much into that because they're going to play their starters a little longer. We were in Greensboro. It's their first game. They're getting them their reps because they haven't seen a lot of time together. But when you saw how they could operate, you're like, man, these guys just hoop. They go out and they just, nothing catches them. Like, if they miss a shot, they're not thinking about it. They're not, their maturity level stood out to me. Because there's times, look, LaMelo Ball takes some shots that you go, what are you doing? Like, why are you taking that shot at this moment? Nobody has a problem with it. Nobody had any issues with it. Nobody hung their heads. There was no infighting type looks. It was just like, all right, cool. Well, let's just go get the next one. And you have elite shooting with Knipple. You have elite scoring with Miller. You have guys that play their roles in the middle. They're dangerous. They're a problem. Not only do I think they can catch Orlando, I think they pass Orlando. And Atlanta can too. Atlanta, we looked at it last night. They had the Grizzlies last night. They have a couple more games with teams like Sacramento and Brooklyn. And then they have an end-of-the-year game with Miami in Miami that could mean a lot. It could mean nothing.
Yeah.
But it's there. And then they have some tough games in there. And we'll see what they are this week when they face Detroit and Boston on a road trip. Then they come home and play Sacramento. But they're building a cushion where they're, you know, they're almost assuredly, in my opinion, going to host at least the play-in tournament game, if not get further ahead. Last night was a really good night for the Hawks. Hornets did not play. Everybody else other than the Raptors, who is grouped between that 5 and 10 spot, lost. And I was like, I think asking the Raptors to lose in Salt Lake City tonight may be a little much to other guys. Like, well, we can keep our fingers crossed. I said, yeah, I can try to hit Powerball too. I might have a better chance.
I thought we were going to get a break. I thought the Mavs were going to beat the Warriors. They had the lead, and then it goes to overtime, and the Warriors won. I thought we were going to get the situation where you get the double win.
Yeah, that would have been for us, but I'm talking for the Hawks themselves, talking about them catching the Magic. So the Magic's struggling right now. But, yeah, it's going to be interesting. These last 3 weeks of the season are going to be loaded with a lot of matchups you have to keep an eye on. Even though the 10 teams in each side are already set, you have what's happening with the teams that are not there, that are more comfortable losing than winning, which is a tough spot to be in, but what do you tell a team? I mean, I was talking with guys in Charlotte about it because they've gone through it, guys in Atlanta about it because they've gone through it. There's never an exact science. I mean, you look at who's gotten the number one pick the last handful of years, and it's never the team that has the worst record. So you don't assure yourself of anything. But this draft is so deep and so loaded if these kids come out that, and I say that because you have to, but if they come out, it's going to be loaded. And that'll also be interesting. What kid that thinks he's a top 10 pick starts getting wind that he's not going to be a top 10 pick and says, well, if I come back next year, I am a top 10 pick and I can make the same money playing at the school I played at this past year or somewhere else where I can get even more exposure and become that top pick. Does anybody make that decision? The way the NIL money's going right now, that's not out of the question. I mean, look at your boy in Oregon. Yeah, I'm good not playing quarterback for the team in New York. So let's go back to Oregon and they'll pay me and then I'll find a better landing spot.
Heck, it's so good in Oregon. Dylan Raiola said, I'll go play at Oregon and sit the bench and then play next year and make more money.
Yeah, well, that's the way this is going. It'll be, you know, I heard you guys talking about it. It'll be interesting to see how this progresses moving forward when you're talking about, Tim's talking about, what, $15 million for a quarterback potentially if he's that good? Like, Texas Tech just opens the checkbook and, you know, says, here you go, because they've got money to spend. And now, look, all of their sports are doing well. Their softball team won a national title, right? So, like,
they've lost in the championship game, but yes.
Oh, did they? I thought they won.
But we think the young woman, she has to be the first person ever to transfer from Stanford to Texas Tech without getting kicked out of school.
That's probably accurate. It turns out the zeros on the check can make that decision fairly easy. But I do know that I think Jason Williams, our old Jason Williams point guard, I think his daughter plays for Texas Tech now. She was at Florida. Both her parents went to Florida.
Uh-huh.
They have an elite softball program. She's really good. Money talks.
Yeah.
She's now playing for Texas Tech. So, yeah, it's interesting. It's hard to go through games like last night when you're on the wrong end of that scoreboard, but you kind of know that's going to happen during this stretch when teams are locked in and playing for something like Atlanta was, like San Antonio is. But in reality, what's San Antonio truly playing for right now? They're not going to catch the Thunder because as hot as they've been, the Thunder have been the same thing. But they'll be locked in, and they're young, and they're learning how to figure this whole thing out, and they've figured out at a rate more quickly than I expected them to. But you look at the schedule next for the Grizzlies, it's brutal. I mean, you've got San Antonio, right? Houston, Chicago, second night of a back-to-back. You come back the next week, you get Phoenix and New York and Toronto, and you catch a little break going to Milwaukee, but you get Cleveland the next night in Memphis. And then you go on the road, and it's Denver and then Utah, and then at Houston at the end, where maybe Houston's got something to play for, maybe they don't. They might be playing to get out of the play-in tournament. They might be playing to get home court advantage. We don't know. Time will tell. The only ones you're looking at are like, okay, Chicago, Milwaukee, Utah, what happens in those games? That'll be interesting to see.
Well, the other thing, like, if you just go back from March 1, like, okay, if you want to complain about the Hawks' defense, I'll listen to it. Eric, they're scoring 125 points a game. They lead the NBA.
They are using their speed, their athleticism, the three-point shot. They lead the NBA in deflections, which people now track more. Hubie Brown was one of the first ones to really track that.
Hubie was so ahead of the curve on everything.
Oh, Hubie's system in today's NBA would thrive, would absolutely thrive. It was a 10-man rotation, but it was based on, we're going to shoot a lot of threes and we're going to play the passing lanes and we're going to play fast. It's exactly what today's NBA is. And he's always been that way. Listening to that man talk back then was prophetic when you think about it now. And I still to this day look back at in my 25 years of being here, the year that I was doing a morning show on another station, and we could go after practice and Hubie would sit down with my co-host and I for 10 minutes after practice, every time they had practice. And by the way, they practiced every day. They didn't have a game. We had a Hubie Brown interview on our radio show, like if they weren't on a road trip twice, three times a week. And he loved it. He just loved to talk basketball and he didn't want anything for it. He just wanted to talk and spew out what was going on in the league. And I'm like, this is an unbelievable stroke of luck. And the fact that he and I got along, and he respected that I was willing to just shut up and listen as a young broadcaster and let him talk and learn and show him that I was learning was amazing. I think that, you know, the thing that may have bonded us was me telling him that I always liked Bernard King. And, you know, he kind of raised an eyebrow. He's like, what do you know about Bernard King? And I told him, like, hey, I was in Golden State when he was there. broke my heart when they traded him to you guys in New York, and we got Michael Ray Richardson, not because I didn't have anything against Michael Ray Richardson, who turned out he could have been phenomenal had it not been a substance abuse issue. But Bernard King was my guy, and I just said the guy could score from anywhere. And he was just an absolute nightmare to cover. And had it not been for a horrific knee injury for him, we talk about him in a very different light. Yet he came back from an injury that ended guys' careers. And that tells you, you know, his journey. He also battled alcohol abuse early in his career. It almost put him out of the league. And to make the Hall of Fame after that, dude, the guy was unbelievable. That's, you know, you created that bond, and learning from Hubie was phenomenal. I mean, it was just unreal. And, you know, seeing him when he was still calling games was always a special moment. But like you said, his offense and the way he played defensively, it is exactly what today's NBA is. It's exactly what they ran.
So we get the Spurs tomorrow night.
Yep.
And I know it could be NBA, you know, hey, we need a discussion topic. But is there a universe where Wemby can't actually win the MVP this year?
Sure. I mean, I don't know how the voting goes anymore. I used to have a vote back in the day. And when I had it, I recall this is about the time you got the ballots.
Yeah.
I had a vote for everything. Every team got three votes. It generally went to the two play-by-play guys and the beat writer. Some teams elected to give one of the color analysts the vote. And I'm actually kind of happy we don't have it anymore. I think I've told the story where they give them to you and you're like, it's kind of like a long-term homework assignment. You don't want to be under the gun. So I started filling mine out, and we really hadn't seen a lot of Kawhi Leonard. We'd only played the Spurs once. I had seen a few games, but he had kind of battled some injuries early on. So when I did the MVP rankings, I didn't have him in there. And I'm like, I know I'm leaving something out here. I'm going to come back to it. So I kind of filled everything out. I had him on my all-NBA first team. And it was the year Steph won the award unanimously. Well, when I went back and redid the stuff that I wanted to re-examine, like defensive player of the year, most improved player, some of the awards that take a little more, I got to do a little deeper dive to see who I really want to vote for here. And I'm not just going to be the guy that, hey, he's a Grizzly, I'm voting for him.
Right.
Because I didn't think that was right. As much as I love those guys, and if they were worthy, I voted for them. If they were worthy of the vote where I gave it to them, they earned it. It wasn't because they were a Grizzly. And I took pride in that. I forgot to go back in and put Kawhi as my number two, and I think I threw Kyle Lowry in number five because he had just a breakout year that year in Toronto, or his last year. I think it was in Toronto where he really changed the complexion of that team. And I was like, I think Kyle's worthy of a little honorary mention here type thing. There were three people that didn't have Kawhi on their ballot. Me, I think it was Tommy Heinsohn, the former Celtics color analyst who, you know, was on CBS and played in the NBA, and one other guy. And this dude made it his mission on what was formerly Twitter, now X, to just call all three of us out, call us every name in the book. Why are we worthy of a vote? This is the most egregious thing ever. So finally, where I replied to the guy and I said, hey, Steph won it unanimously. He was on my first team all NBA, which he got unanimously. It was an oversight when I first filled out the ballot. He's phenomenal, but it doesn't change anything. So ease up a little bit. And he's like, well, what makes you so, you know, worthy of having a vote? And I said, well, I see all 82 of our games. I watch the league on a nightly basis. And you didn't vote for him? I said, truth be told, I haven't seen as much of the Spurs as some of the other people have. And I think that's where the NBA kind of took notice, like, hey, we're asking guys that see their team and live that life. And here's the fact of it. We don't rush to the hotel to watch more basketball. We do watch a lot of basketball away from the games we call, but we're not watching like we are during the game because that's our job. You know, it's as I equated it to years ago, if you work in a hamburger stand 5 days a week and you serve burgers every day and that's what you love to do and you love it, the last place you're going to go for lunch probably is a hamburger stand.
Or what do you not want to make on Saturday night?
Yeah, exactly. When you go home, you don't want to make hamburgers for your friends. So we'll watch the games, but like we don't always, if we have a chance to go to games, sometimes we'll go. Sometimes we say, let's just have a night where we have dinner and enjoy you know, a night away from the game, because you do need it. As much as we love it, and look, you know me, I know I love it as much as anybody. You do need a little time to recharge the batteries, to get away from it. So I'm glad we don't vote for it, but I do see a world where people will go, hey, look at what San Antonio was thought they could be. Look where they are. It's much more than what people expected. It's a faster rise to the top. I thought they would be a playoff contending team, more than likely in the top six, but still very young and still had things to figure out. They figured it out in a hurry. That's a testament to their coach. That's a testament to their players. It's a testament to how good Wemby really is. And, you know, we didn't see all of that because of the way they managed his minutes, and rightfully so. He's their bell cow, and if he has, what was it, the thrombosis in his veins last year, and it's something that you're really concerned about, you're like, all right, we're gonna shut you down because we know where we're going with this. Let's just take that time. And nobody last year was going, oh, the Spurs are tanking. They're protecting their asset. And similar to some other teams that are going through it right now, there are other teams that are just flat out egregiously doing what we talked about, where they don't play guys, and we saw that earlier. And
the Wizards!
That's where the debate comes up. And that's where I think you got to go, hey, look, you know, you got young guys out there. And it's kind of like, I get where people will say, hey, people are talking about how tired guys were 4 and 5 nights, and the old heads will be like, we used to play 4 and 5 nights all the time. We did. But when you're not used to that, it's a lot. And so when the Grizzlies got tired in this last 2-week stretch because they played more games in that 2 weeks than they probably will ever see in their careers again like that, because the NBA doesn't do 4 and 5 nights because they know the toll it takes on the body, that they did get tired and they got mentally fatigued. And you're staying in hotels and you're in there for basically 20 hours max. You unpack what you're wearing the next day, you leave the rest of it packed. You're waking up, you're getting your food when you can, you're getting your rest when you can, you're getting on a bus. And it's